This is Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. Earlier this month, I interviewed Dr. Neil Shah and other clinicians involved in a discussion of his perspective essay in the New England Journal of Medicine. The essay reviews the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence recommendation that the country should take a novel approach to the delivery of babies, often bypassing obstetricians and relying more heavily on midwives and home delivery. That interview was done on video as part of a MedStro discussion. I've adapted the audio portion here, interjecting people's names where you might wonder who's speaking. I will give the URL on the website, but for the impatient, go to medstro.com. That's MEDSTRO.com. And look for the NEJM Group open forums. MedStro and the group are collaborating on these forums. They usually run about 10 days and invite your involvement in discussing pressing clinical issues and sharing your ideas and those of other experts. As a clinician, you'll find them interesting, I think. Here we go. Welcome to day three of a MedStro NEJM group open forum on treatment intensity in childbirth. We have with us this afternoon Dr. Neil Shah, the author of an NEJM perspective article titled A Nice Delivery, that talks about a recent recommendation from the UK's National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, also known as NICE. NICE recommends that women with a straightforward pregnancy are better off delivering at home or in a midwife-led unit than in hospitals under the supervision of an obstetrician. The discussion on MedStro has been wide-ranging. A couple of notable voices in that discussion are with us today. Dr. Kirti Patel, an obstetrician-gynecologist at UMass Memorial Healthcare. Dr. Emily Blosser, a resident in OBGYN at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And Dr. Tony Golan, a vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. We should also say that Dr. Shah is an obstetrician-gynecologist at Beth Israel Deaconess and the founder of the nonprofit Costs of Care and an assistant professor at Harvard. Dr. Shah, your essay is provocative, both thought-provoking and reaction-provoking. How have your colleagues reacted?
We're just going to get right into it, aren't we, Joe?
We're going to jump right in, yeah.
You know, I'd say that if there's ever a good forum for nuanced discussion, it should be the New England Journal of Medicine. And that's part of why I felt comfortable. You know, I think initially when the New England Journal invited me to respond to the NICE guidelines, I wasn't sure if it's something I wanted to do because it's obviously a very thorny issue. And I explicitly say in the article, you know, this is not a home versus hospital debate. It's not a midwife versus OB debate. It's about treatment intensity and when enough is enough. And I really tried to lay that out. And I think, you know, the initial reaction actually has been very positive, particularly from my colleagues. Tony Golan was essentially my boss and fully supported me in writing this. Although I'll say I wrote a companion piece that was for the wider public. And that one has sort of taken off like wildfire. So I wrote it for a website that called The Conversation, which is sort of like a Huffington Post that's based in the UK and Australia. And that ended up getting syndicated to Time Magazine yesterday and The Washington Post today. And that has actually gotten a much more of the sort of debate that I originally was hoping to avoid, with a lot more of the sort of extreme views that people shouting at each other, homes versus hospitals and midwives versus doctors and that kind of thing.
Well, shouting can be fun, but not often productive. You know, this is, I want to throw this out to the rest of the panel. In 2013, the overall cesarean rate in the U.S. was about a third, about 33%, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Even among low-risk pregnancies, it was not much lower, and it was about 27%. But the World Health Organization says that the rate should not be above 15% anywhere in the world. So what's going on? Oh, I know that you all want to answer that question. Kirti Patel.
Kirti, what's the reason? What's the reason for it?
Well, I think it's our, you know, healthcare environment. You know, in the United States, we have, you know, kind of a litigious society, I'd say. You know, it's difficult for OBGYNs who, you know, want a good outcome for mother and baby. To, you know, we do fetal monitoring continuously and, you know, in the inpatient setting. And I think we react, we are very sensitive to any fetal heart rate changes, you know, wanting a good outcome. And then also, you know, and they don't always match, you know, a fetal heart rate tracing may have certain changes that we may react to, but it doesn't actually always play out to, you know, distress. So that's imperfect. And then the environment we're in where, you know, we value having a good outcome and we want to prevent, you know, medical legal consequences. You know, I think that's what escalates the, you know, the C-section rate.
The rate is higher, I believe, in Brazil. It's close to 45% or 50%, and it's also higher in China. Our computers are starting to talk to us. Maybe I've made a mistake or something. And so the United States is not the worst.
The United States is absolutely the worst. So there are other places that have higher cesarean delivery rates than we do, but we're the only place on the entire planet that has had a consistently rising maternal mortality rate for the last 20 years. In sub-Saharan Africa, maternal mortality is going down. In the United States of America, the maternal mortality rate is going up. And these things aren't completely decoupled. I think one of the things that we're trying to convey with this perspective is that there are harms on both ends of the spectrum in healthcare delivery. It happens, you know, patients get harmed when we don't do enough, and that's part of the concern about birth setting, making sure that women have access to the resources that they need to get safe care. And as a result, I think our paradigm of safety improvement and quality improvement in healthcare has been about positive action and doing more to make people safer. But of course, I think actually childbirth is a great example of how doing too much can also harm patients. We don't have great mechanisms yet at a systems level to think about how you turn down treatment intensity when you're doing too much. And so, you know, some of the negative consequences of cesarean delivery rates here in the United States that we don't see in China are born from the fact that we do multiple C-sections. So in China, most people have one child. You know, any of the OBGYNs here can tell you that doing one C-section is not a big deal. Doing the third or fourth C-section, though, can be pretty dicey. And we've got a condition called placenta accreta, which actually has a pretty considerable morbidity and in some cases even mortality. It's become 12 times more common in the last 40 years as cesarean deliveries have become 6 times more common.
That's not good news.
No.
So, any other reactions there?
Tony Golan.
The reasons for the cesarean delivery rate in Brazil and China are really quite different from what they are here as well. Much of that, particularly in Brazil, is patient-driven. And here in the United States, even though there's a lot of talk about patient requesting cesarean delivery, it turns out that that accounts for the vast minority of cesarean deliveries.
So it's a cultural thing. One of the things that Neil mentions in his essay is the fact that people, OBGYNs, are trained in operating suites or encounter most of their patients in something that looks like an OR with scalpels around and instrumentation, which when you're surrounded by these things, you probably would tend to use them. I don't think there's a simple answer to this, but as I'm listening, as I was looking at some of the factors in the discussion about why the United States has got such a high rate. One of the things that's mentioned is the lack of transfer arrangements that are raised in Neil's article. You can't transfer easily people in the U.S. The arrangements aren't there, typically. The other thing is that half the counties in the U.S. don't have access to good OB care. And that's something else that's... So how do we think that the system is going to, without being as, you know, a single payer system, without being as controlled as the British system is, what are some of the things that are possible to address these things? And I would ask Emily, who's training right now, Emily Blosser, you're a resident. What are you being trained in a high tech? You're certainly not being trained in somebody's backyard. I mean, do you have any encounters with midwives? Are you working with midwives at all there?
So just to correct you a little bit, I'm actually just starting my fourth year of medical school. So my clinical experience is exceptionally limited at this phase. What I can tell you about my time on the OBGYN service is that we don't really have a lot of access to midwives. In the city of Birmingham, there is a movement towards people wanting more home births, and people are in the community talking about with their doctors the options of delivering in a hospital versus delivering at home. In the hospital, you don't hear a lot of positive conversation about care from midwives or experiences with midwives, and I can't necessarily give you a specific reason for that, other than I think overall the feeling of lack of control is concerning to a lot of practitioners. I think they're worried about what goes on when they're not there to sort of moderate the situation, which I think also contributes to the reason that we perform a lot of C-sections. I think in the surgical setting, the physicians are really in control of the delivery. They moderate every step of it, as opposed to just allowing a woman to labor on her own, where you're not in control and, you know, you're basically depending on the mother and the child to allow things to happen naturally. And I think that is just inherently uncomfortable for physicians. And so that might contribute to the reason that we send women to the OR faster than maybe we should.
Joe, the combination of statistics that you pointed out are actually the thing that I most wanted to convey in this perspective, which is that I was trying to understand, not in a really one-dimensional way, are home births okay, or are birth center births okay, or midwifery-led births okay, but just under what circumstances can we provide those kinds of options to women safely? How do you sort of set up a system where you're able to do that? I don't think that the British are being cavalier. They care about good outcomes for babies and moms just as much as we do. And so I sort of started with the premise that, they're responsible people, they care about women and babies, and yet they're making this recommendation that seems radical to us. And when I started to really think about what was lacking here in the United States, I realized that we have the problems of a first world country and the problems of a third world country all wrapped up together in a perfect storm. On one hand, 50% of US counties don't have access to a mom or a midwife. Spent last couple months actually traveling around the country, seeing how childbirth works, and realizing that there are many parts of our country where women routinely drive 2 to 3 hours to get to the place that delivers their baby. That's not how I was trained in Boston, where you can throw a pebble and hit a hospital in any direction. But that's really not what most of the country looks like. And when you look at these facilities, they're extremely resource intensive, extremely sophisticated. They've got elaborate blood banks. They've got multiple operating rooms. It takes a lot to maintain. And you can't physically build that in every single part of the country, which is part of our access problem and why, in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, it's much closer to the situation in northern India than it is, to other parts of the United States.
There was one of the commentators on the MedStore discussion is from New Zealand, and pointed out that in certain parts of the country, when people get close to delivery, they move closer to town. So they hang out closer to town because they may not be able to get to areas. And I'm sure that certain parts of the far west and Montana, you know, during the winter are equally difficult and fraught for people who are expecting.
I guess what I'm saying is, in the United States of America, I'm not sure that we should have a system where you have to make a pilgrimage to have a baby.
Right. The way around that, I mean, the county's statistic is interesting. You know, you wonder, because all the standard metropolitan statistical areas are overloaded with hospitals, aren't they? But when you get out into the rural areas, they're not, and so we're facing a problem that we can't solve until we solve a bigger problem, but we don't want to put it aside until the bigger problem is solved.
Right, and I'm not sure that you solve it by dropping a Beth Israel Deaconess or the University of Alabama at Birmingham in each and every one of those places. There's got to be some way of building safe systems and safe facilities for women that don't quite require that level of resource intensity.
Well, at the risk of insulting all of you, it's true that the rate of C-sections goes up with the increased cost of performing one. So,
what do you mean by cost?
You mean
reimbursement, I guess.
Reimbursement.
Reimbursement. And so, one can't help but wonder whether, unconsciously or subconsciously or paraconsciously, physicians are saying, "Do a C-section. Get a mortgage payment." I know that you're not trained to think that way, and I know that you don't think that way, and so I said at the risk of insulting you, but isn't there a danger that unless there is a way to measure that and to say, well, Dr. Billy, whatever, you've done too many C-sections, we're going to cut back the rate of reimbursement for your doing the next 20. Tony, go.
So it turns out that you're both correct and also wrong.
It's a familiar feeling for me.
So when we think about how much money physicians get reimbursed for the services that they provide, physicians themselves, it turns out that physicians actually don't get very much more money, if any, for a C-section versus a vaginal delivery. The hospital does. But the hospital is commonly completely disconnected from the physician's reimbursement. So what the physician actually finds in their bank account is largely unrelated to the mode of delivery.
Gertie Patel.
Yes. I mean, I'd have to agree. I think more and more you're going to see OBGYNs on staff, on, in provider groups that are, owned by an organization. So they're more on salary more than than out in private practice these days. I think.
And even if you're on salary, even if you're on salary, your profits and loss calculation as a physician is based on your professional fees, and those professional fees are very, very similar for each mode of delivery. As a matter of fact, even in situations where they're very, very complex obstetrical patients, physicians, and they may be in the ICU and require hours and hours and hours of very intensive physician-related care, the physician themselves doesn't get that much more money, if any. The hospital does, but not the physician.
And actually, the corollary to Tony's point is that the lever right now that's being used is payments, I think, at the hospital level. And it's part of actually Tony's job now to think about is that, in 2015, we're generally moving from payment paradigm where we're being paid for value. And there are new measures that were responsible for reporting for childbirth, and one of them is C-section rates on low-risk women. And in many states now in the United States, just as of this year, part of the hospital's payment is getting tied to the target rates of low-risk C-sections. And then the question is, if you are in Tony's position and you're somebody who's in charge of running a labor floor, you know, what do you do then to make sure that you're lowering your C-section rate but also doing it in a way that's safe? You know, coming back to that idea of 15% and the WHO recommendation, that's kind of a controversial recommendation. 15% is not very evidence-based. We actually have no idea what the optimal C-section rate is. And, you know, C-sections are life-saving surgeries, so we've got to figure out how to do this in a way that makes women better off by not operating on them unnecessarily, but also making sure we're not picking the right ones to not do.
Isn't it true, though, that, and this, I'm sure it's not the case at UMass or University of Alabama or Beth Israel Deaconess, but there are hospitals where, you know, there are more people. I noticed this about 30 years ago when I was working on the Shattuck Street offices, that there were more people walking around with suits on than lab coats. And I thought, oh, these are, here come the business school graduates. And so I don't know whether there are subtle pressures, but the hospitals do like revenue. That's how they get to hire good people like you. And so I wonder if there are subtle hints. And I'm sure you would say I'm right and wrong again. So I'll just leave it at that. I would like though to come back to the core question, which is how is it that is it necessary for us to do a kind of a cultural transformation in American medicine to address the problem of overtreatment? And I'll let you talk about that, Neil.
I think you know what I think, Joe. I mean, I think that we do. Obviously, I mean, we've got a problem. For the last 40 years, over the course of one to two generations of moms, we've seen C-section rates skyrocket here in the U.S. and actually all over the world. And the truth of the matter is we have no explanation for it. It's not driven by medical malpractice. It's not to say that OBGYNs don't think about medical malpractice. I do. All of us do. But the medical malpractice system hasn't really changed appreciably in the last 20 years, and yet C-section rates have doubled. So it's hard to blame the whole ballgame on just reimbursement or medical malpractice. It's not really driven by patient risk. C-section rates in 18-year-old healthy women have gone up just as fast as they've gone up in 35-year-old obese women. It's not driven by IVF. That's a pretty small margin. It's not driven by patient preference. Tony mentioned that you know, it's less than 1% of women who request C-sections. And so we're not really sure what's driving it. And there's very clearly some very significant physical harms to patients and financial ones, frankly. It's $5 billion we spend annually in the United States on C-sections that don't need to happen in retrospect. And so this is a huge problem. And I think part of it is cultural. Part of it is honestly thinking about this from a systems level. And there's a couple different things that we can do. I mean, on one hand, we're seeing increasing amounts of payment reform for maternity care in honestly fairly unlikely places. South Carolina is actually one of the leaders in the nation in holding hospitals accountable for their C-section rates. We're seeing increasing transparency. Consumer Reports, U.S. News, you know, not the places that you'd think are now starting to report hospital C-section rates. And for better or for worse, and patients are definitely paying attention to that. In 2015, you can look up quality for any other commodity that you buy on Yelp and Amazon, so people are expecting that in healthcare, and we're seeing that dynamic. And I think we're seeing that patients are paying more out of pocket for care, and we're seeing them be much more discerning about where they go. I think all those dynamics are sort of coming together to create this window of opportunity to redesign how we deliver care.
Kirti, do you have a perspective on this? You were leaning forward as if you wanted to say something.
well, I was just repositioning, but but I do have an opinion. I would agree. Our C-section rate is too high. I I feel mine isn't personally, but but no, I don't. I do have a higher rate than 15%, and I do think, I mean, I often tell my patients, you know what? Most of the time, you don't need me. I'm just there for an emergency. You know, I feel like you could probably deliver your. Our practice has a midwife, and we work closely with the midwife. However. You know, I do see that our inpatient model of care, you know, even the midwife has her patients on continuous fetal monitoring. They get IVs, they, you know, blood work. I mean, it's sort of the culture to do these things. We don't have a innovative model. And just as CMS has these innovative models, you know, ACOs for primary care, perhaps we need to introduce an innovative model of care, you know, a collaborative model with midwife, nurse, and physician, you know, OB or family practice doctor, where we can kind of redesign the care and show that and prove that we can reduce C-section rates safely and have excellent outcomes. And once, if we can do that, then I think we can get broader support. I think from going from here to what they have in UK, the UK, you know, is difficult because, well, firstly, our payment system, you know, they have universal health care. I think that kind of encourages more collaboration than our siloed health system. But I think something like what they're, you know, an innovative a study of a population of you know, patients at a center might be the way to go.
Emily, the you've been revealed to be a medical student. I'm sorry that I.
That's okay.
I was trying to skip a year of medical school for you, but I'm sorry. You still have to pay that tuition. But do you get a sense that there are winds of change blowing through are people in your family physicians, and are you the first one in your family to be a physician?
I'm the first in my family to be a physician. A physical therapist, but that's as close to the medical community as we.
Do you sense that there's a cultural change coming in medicine?
I do. Primarily, I think a lot of my peers are really interested in really a patient-centered approach and individualized medicine. That's a term that gets thrown around a lot, not one that's easily defined or easily implemented. But I think one of the questions in the online discussion that was interesting to me was somebody said that, or asked the question, what do we need to do to convince women that it's safe to have babies at home? And my gut reaction to that was, what do we need to do to convince OBGYNs that it's safe to tell women that it's safe to have babies at home? And so in terms of sort of changing the mentality, I think that's going to have to start from the medical community so that we can convince people that these sorts of home births are safe and perfectly reasonable in a number of different circumstances. But I really, in terms of the change that I see among physicians, I think that there's much more consideration now on evidence-based approaches than I am used to hearing about in the past. And I think that's probably a movement in the right direction.
Neil, I want to give you the last word. Is there something about your article that you'd like to footnote, or?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that's fundamental to the British approach to this, you know, one of the key differences is they have a single payer system. The other key difference is that they use midwives much more often than we do. But there's no silver bullet solution here. I mean, they use midwives more often than we do, but they still have a 25% C-section rate, which they feel is much too high. And so what they've decided to do, they've decided that OBs are hardwired to operate. And maybe that's because that's part of what we do and it's part of our training. And so if you make that assumption, there are two solutions. One is to change the wiring of the OB And that's evidence-based medicine that starts with Emily all the way through her training. The other solution is, rather than changing the wiring, is to just route people around the OB when you really need one. And that's really the approach that the British system has taken. And it's going to take some time to know whether or not it's effective, to be totally honest. They just implemented these guidelines in December, and you know, time will tell. But I guess the other just very quick footnote is that this is not a knock entirely on the U.S. What we do very, very well here is take care of extremely sick patients, probably better than anywhere else in the world. And you know, my concern in all of this is just making sure that we're not, as a generalist, an OB-GYN generalist, is that we're not leaving the healthy women behind.
All right. Well, I you know, this is a fascinating discussion, and it's and it really stands in for a lot of things about the way that we deliver, that you all deliver health in the United States, and it was I guess we all owe you, Neil, a debt of gratitude for taking that assignment from the NEJM and writing about NICE. And we hope that the outcome for you is nice. So I want to thank Dr. Neil Shah, Dr. Kirti Patel, almost Dr. Emily Blosser, and Dr. Tony Gullin for spending time with us this afternoon. And I want to encourage the listeners and or watchers out there to jump into this discussion and contribute your ideas to it. Thanks very much again.
That was Clinical Conversation podcast number 177. Thanks to Dr. Jennifer Joe and Jim Ryan of MedStro for letting me adapt the open forum. As I said up front, you can find the complete forum at medstro.com. Thanks also to Kristen Kelly, my executive producer, and to you, dear listeners, for being here. Your suggestions are most welcome. Contact me at jelia@nejm.org. See you next time.